Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Sean, and I will be your conference operator today. At this time, I would like to welcome everyone to the Pioneer ACO Special Open Door Forum conference call. All lines have been placed on mute to prevent any background noise. After the speaker's remarks, there will be a question-and-answer session. If you would like to ask a question during this time, simply press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. To withdraw your question, you may press the pound key. Thank you. Ms. Barbara Siebenhaar of CMS, you may begin your conference call.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Barbara Siebenhaar, and I'm with the CMS Office of Public Engagement. Thank you for everyone being with us on the call today. We're here to discuss some exciting new options for a whole range of providers across the healthcare spectrum that are considering being a part of accountable care organizations. Accountable care organizations are one of the most innovative tools provided by the Affordable Care Act that will help us create a healthcare delivery system that is sustainable over the long term. Today, we're discussing a new initiative from the CMS Innovation Center, the Pioneer ACO model. I'm joined by Dr. May Pham and Dr. Mandy Cohen from the Innovation Center to provide an overview and answer your questions about the Pioneer ACO model. I just want to make sure folks know that this is not a press call. This is for stakeholders only. And also that the encore recording of this call will be available about 3 or 4 hours after the conclusion of this call. So that means about 5:30 Eastern Time, and you can access it by dialing 1-800-642-1687 and asking for call number 7096-1792. If you have questions after this call ends, you may send them to pioneeraco@cms.hhs.gov. That's pioneeraco@cms.hhs.gov. I'll now turn the call over to Dr. Pham and Dr. Cohen.
Great. Thank you, Barb. And hi, everyone. My name is Dr. Mandy Cohen. I'm the Director of Stakeholder Engagement for the Innovation Center. And we just wanted to welcome you all to the call today, and thank you for taking the time out of your busy schedule to join us. We're going to be reviewing the Innovation Center new Pioneer ACO model, the request for applications that was announced just 2 weeks ago, and go through any questions you might have. I think we all know that the path towards a sustainable healthcare system can't be through cutting care or slimming down coverage. It has to be through improving care, and we can achieve better care, better health, and lower costs by putting patients at the center of our healthcare system. And we believe accountable care organizations, or ACOs, is a perfect example of how we can get there. About 2 months ago, CMS published its initial proposed rules on how to implement ACOs, and the public comment period for that rule, the Medicare Shared Savings Program, closed yesterday. This call will not be addressing the Medicare Shared Savings Program. Rather, it's to discuss the Innovation Center's new model, the Pioneer ACO model. This model will offer an accelerated pathway to forming an ACO to providers who are already ahead of the pack in terms of coordinating care, even before those new regulations for the Medicare Shared Savings Program go into effect. So again, we'll only be focusing our comments today on the Pioneer ACO model and answering questions about that request for applications. The comment period for the proposed rule did close yesterday, and we are currently culling through those comments and are sure to have a stronger final rule later this year as a result of your comments and feedback. So thank you for those of you who did submit comments to that rule. So now I am joined by Dr. Mai Pham and by Sean Kavanaugh, who are here to provide some additional background on the Pioneer ACO model and to answer your questions. But before I turn the call over, I just wanted to highlight one other offering from the CMS Innovation Center around ACO, and that's a learning opportunity to support providers around the country who want to learn some fundamental skills about how to build an ACO. This is an opportunity to learn from experts around the country who have been doing integrated care. Participation in the session won't have a factor in your selection of participation in any of the CMS ACO programs, but are incredibly rich resource and free for you to take advantage of. Our first session is in Minneapolis, June 20th to 22nd, and there will be three additional sessions September, October, and November of this year. So please check back with the Innovation Center website, www.innovations.cms.gov, for additional updates on that. And so with that, I would just turn the call over to Dr. Maifam.
Thanks very much, Mandy, and thank you for joining us today. I wanted to start off before we described, gave you an overview of the Pioneer ACO model, to announce that we are going to push back the deadline for the letter of intent and the application. We have heard loud and clear from many provider organizations that they would appreciate more time to put together the organizational backing that they need to do this, and also to put together as strong an application as possible. So the new due dates are, for the letter of intent, June 30th, and for the application itself, August 19th. So a two-week extension on the letter of intent and a month extension on the application. So I wanted to start by explaining the context for the Pioneer ACO model, that it is part of a unified CMS strategy for ACOs that acknowledges and wants to leverage the fact that provider organizations are starting from different starting points with different levels of experience and appetites for managing risk. The Pioneer ACO model is designed for the more advanced organizations that have experience in delivering care across settings for defined populations of patients, as well as in managing financial risk. The goal is to complement the shared savings program through the Pioneer model, as well as to inform future changes to the shared savings program. Some key features of the Pioneer model that we would like you to take away are that there is a longer participation agreement period. The agreement lasts for a minimum of 3 years, but CMS and Pioneer ACOs can jointly decide to extend that agreement to up to a maximum of 5 years. There's greater financial gain in terms of higher risk and higher reward for Pioneer ACOs as compared to the shared savings program. And in particular, the payment arrangement includes a transition away from fee-for-service and toward population-based payments starting in the third year. We also will expect Pioneer ACOs to engage with their other payers, such as private health plans or Medicaid state agencies, to enter similar outcomes-based arrangements such that by the end of the second year of the Pioneer model, the majority of the ACO's total revenues will be committed to these types of contracts. We have a more flexible approach toward beneficiary alignment. We are allowing the option of either prospective or retrospective alignment. The procedures that are outlined in the RFA are consistent with prospective alignment for simplicity. And ACOs that are interested in retrospective alignment, we would work with. Finally, an overarching ethic in the Pioneer model is a posture of flexibility towards the unique needs of individual organizations working in individual communities. We offer flexibility in the payment arrangements, both in the core model that's described in the RFA, and we are actively soliciting suggestions from applicants for an alternative payment arrangement. We will synthesize those suggestions and distill them down to one or two, and again, offer those with limited options around some of the key parameters. I wanted to just repeat for those who might have missed the earlier announcement that we are pushing back the deadline for the letter of intent to June 30th and the application to August 19th to give providers more time to put together a strong application. Another point of clarification is that we understand that there are some people who have had difficulties understanding how to fill out the data use agreement, and we've now added instructions for doing this on the CMMI website. Those organizations that have already completed the DUA and submitted their LOI do not need to submit a revised version. And with that, I wanted to turn it back to Barb and open up the discussion for comments and questions.
Don, it's Barb. If we could please go ahead and tell people how to queue up to ask their questions, I'd be grateful. Thank you.
At this time, I'd like to remind everyone that in order to ask a question or make a comment, please press star, then the number 1 on your telephone keypad. We'll pause for just a moment to compile the Q&A roster. Your first question comes from the line of Sarah Smith from Peck Manningen. Your line is now open.
Hi, thank you. I was just wondering, will the letter of intents, after they are submitted, will they be made public online?
That's a very good question. The letters of intent will not be made public. I did just want to also iterate, the letters of intent are non-binding. They are required for planning purposes, but they are non-binding.
Thank you.
John, our next question, please.
Your next question comes from the line of Jennifer Jackman from Monarch Healthcare. Your line is now open.
Thank you. On the request for application, there's a section regarding summarizing expenditure and quality performance data for other purchaser contracts that you're in, and it just says summarize it to date. How far back would you like the information to go?
I think it need not be extensive. I think recent history is what we're after. So we would like for, I understand that especially in California, some provider groups have extensive experience with these types of arrangements. So what we would find most useful is recent data. So I would say within the past 3 to 5 years.
Thank you.
Sean, our next question, please.
Your next question comes from the line of Mayan Shaw from American Health. Your line is now open.
Hi, this is Mayan Shaw from American Health Alliance. The question is, since the letter of intent date has been postponed, and if the intent is that Medicare Shared Savings Program, we need to apply for that also, will there be any conflict?
There should not be any conflict. Our timelines are constructed so that organizations should know how they fared in the Pioneer application process before they have to decide about participation in the Shared Savings Program.
Sean, our next question, please.
Your next question comes from the line of Jane Alwalker from the Association of American Colleges. Your line is now open.
Hi, this is actually Karen Fisher, and I have two questions. I'm wondering if you could expand a little bit in the Pioneer ACO program. You emphasize the word group of primary care providers when you talk about beneficiary alignment. And can you tell us a little bit more about what your thinking is when you talk about a group of primary care providers? And then secondly, you expand a little bit more about the performance expenditure comparisons and the growth rates. And you talk about using national growth rates for matched cohorts and national reference population. And could you just walk that through a little bit for us?
Sure. Why don't I take the first one and ask Sean Kavanaugh to take the second one. So when we conduct alignment, what we will do is we will flag all of the MPIs for primary care providers within an ACO applicant organization. We will similarly apply a joint flag to groups of primary care provider MPIs that are affiliated with other ACO applicants or with other TINs, other tax identification numbers that might not be ACO applicants. And then the alignment algorithm essentially rank orders those groups of MPIs and asks which group of MPIs billed for the plurality, meaning the greatest amount of the primary care evaluation and management allowed charges for that beneficiary. And whichever group of MPIs wins, quote unquote, wins in that alignment competition is the group that the beneficiary will be aligned with. I just want to make sure that that was clear, Karen, before we moved on to your second question.
Yes, thank you.
Okay.
On the second question, I have two answers. The first is that the detailed specifications of how the base expenditures are calculated how they're trended forward to create an expenditure target will be available publicly in the coming
week. Within the next month.
Within the next month. So there is a fair amount of detail that goes into it that that applicants should be familiar with, so we will make the specifications available. I'll give you a high-level description right now. My just described how beneficiaries are aligned. Once a group of beneficiaries have been aligned with an ACO, we will look back at the actual expenditures on behalf of those beneficiaries for the prior 3 years, weighting the most recent year more heavily. That will and trend them forward to the current year. That will create the baseline expenditure. Now, that group of beneficiaries has unique characteristics in that, one, they lived through the prior 3 years, and they had an evaluation and management visit and other criteria. But in the coming year, the performance year, some of those beneficiaries may die, some will age. So you have a unique characteristics in the base year and the performance year. So when we develop the appropriate trend factor to set the expenditure target, we need to look at a national cohort that has those same criteria. So we'll create a cohort from national beneficiaries who also lived through the prior 3 years, had an E&M visit, and met the other criteria. And we'll see what their history was from the base year to the performance year, adjusted for age and sex and other appropriate characteristics. And that will be the trend factor that will be applied to develop the expenditure target. Again, it's fairly straightforward in concept. There are some details that everybody needs to know. We will make those available.
Okay. Some of those details, if I could just take that description down one more level, is to explain that we will be developing those growth rates for national reference cohorts by specific age and sex strata. So we're using up to 12 age strata, very fine demarcations, gender. We might well adjust for other characteristics such as race. What we are trying to do is to account for the factors that an ACO does not have control over. But in effect, and what you should take away is that the best predictor of what the beneficiary's cost will be in the coming year is what the beneficiary's actual cost was in the prior year, and that's our starting point.
And can I just ask two follow-ups? One is, when you talk about the national cohort, are you talking about all Medicare fee-for-service beneficiaries, or are you going to create a national cohort based out of ACO beneficiaries?
All national beneficiaries.
Who could have been aligned with an ACO, but not necessarily were aligned with an ACO.
Who had the E&M visit, but may not necessarily be with an ACO.
Exactly.
And secondly, are you going to do a severity adjustment with the national cohort, or is that not necessary?
Right. So the reason that we are using the beneficiary's actual expenditures is that that is a stronger predictor than applying a severity adjustment on top of a geographic or other average.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Karen. Sean, our next question, please.
Yes, ma'am. Your next question comes from the line of John Yoversleeve from IDA. Your line is now open.
My question I must have missed something here, but where do I go to get the letter of intent and the application form?
Sure. Thanks, John. If you go to the Innovation Center website, that's www.innovations.cms.gov, there's a link right off of the homepage that says Pioneer ACO Model. That will take you to the request for application that has the full description of the program we're talking about now, as well as the letter of intent and instructions for submitting both the letter of intent and the application. So again, that's www.innovations.cms.gov.
Thank you.
Donna, next question, please.
Your next question comes from the line of Alan Osman from Memorial Eye. Your line is now open.
Good afternoon. I had experience in the 90s with managed care in California and now represent a specialist group. And I'm interested in understanding the first question, if the LOIs will not be published. When applications are submitted, will those be published?
Uh, Our intent is not to publish the application because there is information submitted in those applications that will be considered confidential by both the applicant organization and by us.
Understand that part. Would a list of the applicants be available?
Alan, we're going to have to follow up and find out based on our contracting processes and the legal parameters around that about whether we can share that information, but we will make that, we will let you know the answer to that question in the future.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Sean, our next question, please.
Your next question comes from the line of Jeff Squire from New Haven. Your line is now open.
I have a question. In reading the information in the background, the FTC regulations will be followed. And if you need an expedited review, if your PSA is over 50%, how will you account for that in this shortened time frame?
I believe that what the RFA states is that we will prioritize applications from organizations that do not require a full review from FTC DOJ.
Thank you.
Does that answer your question, Jeff?
Yes, it does.
Thank you. Our next question, please.
Your next question comes from the line of Barbara Gilas from Advocate Healthcare. Your line is now open.
Thank you. I had a question about something you mentioned in the introduction. You said there was going to be a posture of flexibility in payment arrangements, and you were actively asking for other options for payment. I was unclear whether those would then be able to be addressed within this RFP period, or whether that would be responded to later.
The point of asking for these suggestions is so that we can do the actuarial modeling on our end during the selection process and then offer up to the selected Pioneer ACOs an alternative payment arrangement that we believe best meets what we are hearing from the marketplace, that the marketplace wants, and will generate savings for the Medicare trust funds, that we would offer up those additional options before the participation agreements are signed.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Vilas. Our next question, please, Sean.
Yes, ma'am. Your next question comes from the line of David Oakley from Manette Montefiore. Your line is now open.
Hi. In the RFA, it refers to demonstration of financial resources to accept the risk. It mentions letters of credit, but it also specifically says, or other devices. Certainly, in many states, in order to demonstrate wherewithal to accept financial risk, one of the common devices is a simple financial guarantee agreement from the provider to the HMO, or in this case, to CMS. Can you give us any elaboration of what you're thinking about in terms of what acceptable alternatives would be and or, you know, how the financial documentation review would progress?
Thank you for that question. It's an area we've spent a lot of time thinking about, and the reason it's not explicit in the RFA is we very much wanted to hear from applicants what is going on in the marketplace and by state regulators. So we would be interested in hearing what you've done, what Montefiore has done with its commercial payers and what's required under New York state law, and we would take that information and work with you to find what would be acceptable to the Medicare program.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Oakley. Our next question, please, Sean.
Yes, ma'am. Your next question comes from the line of Judy Chester from New York City Health. Your line is now open.
Hello. I was just going to ask you to repeat the new deadline dates.
Sure. The letter of intent is now due June 30th, and the application is now due August 19th.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Chester. Our next question, please, Sean.
Ma'am, your next question comes from the line of Jay Cohen from Monarch Healthcare. Your line is now open.
Hi, Mai, Mandy, and Sean. How are you doing today? I first wanted to commend you and the entire Innovation Center team for taking a great step in advancing the ACO notion. with the RFA as it was put out. My question is, with the delay in the initial deadlines, does that push back the rest of the timelines in the program, or is it still your intent and desire to try to get Pioneer ACOs launched as quickly as you had laid out before?
I believe that the RFAJ states that we are aiming for the third or fourth quarter of 2011. We are obviously not going to, we're obviously going to try to not place pioneers in a position of finding out that they've been selected one day and then having the performance period begin the next week. So we will work hard to make sure that there is a comfortable and constructive interval between those.
Thank you, Mr. Cohen. Our next question, please, Sean.
Yes, ma'am. Your next question comes from the line of Alexander Garcia. Please state your organization. Your line is now open. Mr. Garcia, if your line is on mute, please unmute.
Hi, I'm sorry. My name is Alexander from Estevez and Garcia in New Jersey. And I have actually a very, very basic question. You know, I'm hearing all these high-level questions, and I'm almost embarrassed, but... in looking at the RF, it's unclear, and actually you gave a little bit of a hint, I think, in your opening statements where you said that the Pioneer ACO program is really geared for those that are already ahead of the pack when it comes to, I guess, innovative thinking or other payment arrangements. And I wanted to know if you envisioned completely new groupings or new... corporate structures or governance structures being able to apply for this in their letter of intent, would you require that it already all be established, or could a plan be set forth in the letter of intent, or are you really looking for people that have already been working together that way?
I think that we don't have explicit expectations for whether the single entity is new or not, but what we would be looking for in the application and is outlined in the selection criteria is a history of strong working relationships and demonstrated experience in terms of population care management and management of financial risk. Those are the important criteria, not so much when the entity was created.
Thank you. That's very helpful.
Thank you, Ms. Garcia. Our next question, please, Sean.
Your next question comes from the line of Vic Saini from Florida Accountable Services. Your line is now open.
Real quickly, the question would be, can the ACO be directed specifically by a cardiology group, or does it require the affiliation between a cardiology group and primary care docs? And to follow up, can an ACO be focused on one single disease grouping, or does it have to be a multi-specialty and a multi-disease grouping?
We are agnostic with respect to the provider composition of an ACO, but I need to remind you that the beneficiary alignment algorithm first prioritizes assignment to primary care providers. There is a secondary step should those beneficiaries, some of them, not have had a great number of primary care services delivered during the baseline period. In that second step, we would then align them to certain eligible specialists. We are agnostic with respect to what conditions the ACO chooses to focus on, but the expenditure calculations and the construct for accountability here is for the total cost of care, and the quality performance metrics and patient experience metrics will also be focused on the total beneficiary experience.
Thank you very much. Our next question, please, Sean.
Yes, ma'am. Your next question comes from the line of Michael James. Please state your organization. Your line is now open.
Thank you. This is Michael James from Genesis PHO in Flint, Michigan. Question was relating to the quality measures. In your statement, you said you're going to rely upon the final regs under the ACO for quality measures. Is there any thought about a rolling out of those 65 over 3 years, similar to what we did in the primary care group model, or do you still anticipate full compliance within the first year?
I'm very sorry. It's a very reasonable question, but because the comment period has closed on the NPRM, I can't comment on the shared savings program directly.
Okay.
But I will take the opportunity to say that we understand that our reliance on certain parameters within the final rule does introduce an element of uncertainty for applicants, and we're sensitive to that. So I just wanted to reiterate for those who didn't, who weren't aware, that even if an organization submits an application to the Pioneer model and is accepted and begins the program, that they have until January of 2012 to withdraw after the final rule is published if they decide that the parameters that would apply to the Pioneer model are not acceptable.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. James. Our next question, please, Sean.
Our next question comes from the line of Susan Rutger from Plodga Medical Services. Your line is now open.
I'm assuming you mean me. The name is Susan Wilger. Anyway, my question has to do with the provider mix. It says that providers need to be exclusively affiliated with one ACO. And I'm curious, oftentimes in very rural or frontier areas, you do have providers that provide services at different locations, which could be geographically quite distant from each other. So how would that apply to, say, providers that you're using for telehealth purposes, and how would that provide to your specialists?
So to clarify, the RFA says that we expect primary care physicians to affiliate exclusively with one ACO across the shared savings program and the Pioneer model. What that does not mean is that that provider need only practice in one practice site, because an ACO is a single entity that where the providers have jointly agreed to take on accountability for a population of patients. The providers may practice at however many sites they deem appropriate, but if they want to be a part of an ACO program, they need to decide which organization they're going to affiliate with for purposes of expenditure calculations and quality performance measurement. That is the guide. In terms of specialists, the RFA also explicitly states that we do not expect specialists to necessarily be exclusively affiliated with one ACO.
Okay, thanks for the clarification.
And I just wanted to emphasize that the reason the distinction between primary care providers and specialists in this regard is that we believe a strong primary care foundation is the core of care coordination. And so it does not make sense to us that a primary care physician would want to be affiliated with more than one ACO.
Thank you for your comments. Our next question, please, Sean.
Yes, ma'am. Your next question comes from the line of Peng Mei Chung from Montessori Medical. Your line is now open.
Hi, thanks very much. Henry Chung from Montessori Medical Center. I want to go back to the issue about primary care attribution and beneficiary alignment. It's clear that you're going to allow some specialists to be included if patients have less than 10% of E&M visits related to primary care physicians. I guess one question I have is, how will you determine that, given that we have internists in particular, but other specialties as well, who are double boarded and are providing some mixture of primary care as well as specialty services as a specialist?
So, Henry, we're going to use the provider specialty code that is in Medicare databases, and I can reassure you that in independent research, we found that there is over 95% agreement between that specialty code and the self-reported primary specialty of the physician. This is based on physician survey data. So while cardiologists might well provide primary care services,
we have to draw the line somewhere because those are not coded as such in claims. And that's the distinction that we're going to make.
That's very helpful. Can I have a brief unrelated follow-up? Given the number of initiatives that CMMI may be rolling out over the next few months, the question is, could an institution apply for, say, Pioneer, but also continue to take advantage of other initiatives that are not related to the ACO category? For example, the FQHC demo that was recently released. Is there any exclusions that an institution needs to worry about in terms of taking advantage of these initiatives?
We definitely don't want that concern about what might be coming around the corner to be a barrier to participation. We strongly encourage organizations to evaluate each model as it becomes available on its own merits with regard to how good a match it is for them. If there comes along a model that the organizations believe are a better match for them or that we and they believe would work well in concert together, we would bend over backwards to make that work.
The one caveat I would add is that in the case where both programs involve shared savings, there would not be a shared savings allowed twice for the same beneficiary for the same set of services.
That's crystal clear. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Our next question, please, Sean.
Ma'am, your next question comes from the line of Keith Plazy from Brown and Tolland Physicians. Your line is now open.
Hi, thank you. I really appreciated the information on calculation of expenditures. I think that was Sean Cavanaugh who spoke. I'm wondering if you could give a little bit more detail with special focus on end-of-life care. As you know, end-of-life costs are very high. It's a significant factor for Medicare beneficiaries. So in the first, the prior 3 years, if there's no end-of-life services yet needed, and you draw up some kind of calculation, during the performance years, as a beneficiary gets sicker and sicker and then there's end-of-life care, how does that get factored in? Because that could be a significant financial concern for an ACO. Thank you.
Thank you for the question. It's actually an excellent question, and we've spent a lot of time trying to make sure our calculations take into account this very factor. And the short answer to your question is our primary means of adjusting for that is this national cohort approach. As you point out, the population that will be aligned will be people who survived for 3 years, so who did not receive end-of-life care. And yet in the performance years, some subset of them may die and have expensive periods because of that. We will establish an appropriate rate of growth for the ACOs based on a national cohort who have those same characteristics, meaning the national cohort will not be all fee-for-service beneficiaries, but it will be those who lived during the three-year base period, so did not have end-of-life care at that time, but who had the potential and some of whom did die in the performance years. So you would expect a similar trajectory of lower cost because of no death to some growth because of expensive periods involving death. So that's the primary mechanism. As my Sam indicated earlier on the call, in addition to that rate of growth, we are adjusting by age categories, sex categories, and we're considering other appropriate adjustments. But the purpose is to recognize that there will be more expenses and different expenses in the performance year than in the base year.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for your comment and your question. Our next question, please, Sean.
Your next question comes from the line of Jack Somers from Community Care. Your line is now open.
Thank you. Two questions. One, the SSM, when it came out, recognized that even within that model, it was a very aggressive approach, and they were wondering about the January 1st deadline, perhaps even extending it to July 1st. When the Pioneer model came out, it was even more aggressive, suggesting a startup in the fourth quarter of 2011. With the adjustment to the LOI and app dates, is there some adjustment in when rollout will be?
As I stated before, we purposely left ourselves some flexibility in the RFA by referring to the third or fourth quarter of 2011. and we are going to see how the process goes for application and selection. I just want to reiterate, I can't give you a concrete answer to that because we're right now standing by what is in the RFA, but I can promise that we are committed to not we are committed to giving selected pioneer ACOs a comfortable time period during which, after selection, during which they can begin to ramp up for the first performance period.
Thank you.
Thank you for your comment. Our next question, please, Sean.
Your next question comes from the line of Alex Islin. Please state your organization. Your line is now open.
Hi, I'm calling from the New York State Department of Health, and I was just wondering the rationale behind comparing the ACO's baseline to a national reference population.
So one of the things that the Innovation Center is tasked with doing is testing new service delivery and payment models in order to inform future Medicare policy. And in this particular case, we have an opportunity to inform future changes to the shared savings program. One of those alternative approaches is novel benchmark methods. And one of the reasons to test the method that we are is that traditional benchmark calculations basically take a geographic or population average expenditure and then adjust that based on beneficiaries' diagnostic codes and risk index. And what happens when one does that is that questions arise about providers upcoding HCC scores, and then there's countervailing pressures to limit that potential upcoding, with lots of questions about the validity on either side. What we were hoping to do is to develop a method that avoids a lot of that dissension and disagreement by finding a method that tries to adjust for the exogenous factors, the factors about a beneficiary's expenditures that the ACO
May, are you on the line?
Excuse me, Ms. Cohen, if you're still connected, if your line is on mute, please unmute.
Do we have it now?
Ms. Cohen, if your line is on mute, please unmute. Excuse me, Ms. Sebuhar, it appears that the line of Ms. Cohen has dropped. One moment, please, while we attempt to reestablish it.
Thank you very much. I appreciate everybody's patience as we deal with technical difficulties. Thank you.
Apologize. We our line dropped for some reason, and Sean Kavanaugh was in the middle of giving additional information on the last question.
Yeah, I was just going to supplement the answer that Mai gave, which is, as she indicated, we test new payment and delivery system models, and in the particular case of the Pioneer ACO, what we hope to do is develop lessons for the shared savings program in future generations of the shared savings program. And as you know, there's a national reference rate of growth in statute used for the shared savings program. So while we're not using that formula per se, we've tweaked it somewhat. We didn't want to go too far afield from what's in the statute for that, but we did want to do something somewhat different.
Thank you.
Thank you. Sean, our next question, please.
Yes, ma'am. Your next question comes from the line of Emily Brower from Atrius Health. Your line is now open.
Hi. I wanted to ask about the stated objective of moving towards population-based payment, specifically in the third year of the program. And for some clarification, it looks like in the example that's described in the documentation and particularly used in Appendix B is really more of a partial cap or a cash flow payment for services that are expected to be billed by the ACO, and there's still a settlement for total costs or total population-based payment at the end of the period. Is that correct?
Emily, you're correct on that interpretation, and we, in fact, tried to flag that in the RFA in the text by saying that this was a deliberate attempt at giving providers more revenue flexibility and that it did not change the risk profile going from year two to year three. However, I want to emphasize that we very much want to see suggestions for alternative constructions of the payment arrangement from applicants, and that can include different constructions of the population-based payment.
Thanks. If I may ask a second question, which is that someone touched on earlier, which is relationship with other programs. We may have a small subset of patients that would be in a 3026 or community-based care transitions program, and wondering, since that's not explicitly a shared savings program, if there's any conflict with the Pioneer ACO program.
If there is not a shared savings component, we would encourage you to participate in both.
Thank you.
Thank you. Our next question, please, Sean.
Yes, ma'am. Your next question comes from the line of Carl Kovacs. Please state your organization. Your line is now open.
Thank you. This is Carl Kovacs from the Michigan Bureau of Community Mental Health Services. And I was wondering what your thoughts were regarding the role of public mental health within the ACO program. And the second question I have is, how do you see health plans participating in the Pioneer ACO program? Thank you.
Regarding your first question, if you look through the application and the selection criteria for Pioneers, you will see that we explicitly will favor applicants that have active working collaborations with community-based organizations, including mental health care providers. With regards to your second question, I'm sorry, could you remind me what the role of health plans? We are looking for provider organizations to be the primary applicants to the Pioneer model. However, we fully expect that some applicant organizations will be co-owned with a health plan, and that may have its advantages and disadvantages. And the application allows applicants to describe those pros and cons to us.
Great. Thank you very much.
Sean, our next question, please.
Yes, ma'am. Your next question comes from the line of Stephen Rosenroll from Montefiore. Your line is now open.
Hi, Steve Rosenthal. Two quick questions. One is, you had mentioned earlier that organizations perhaps whose PSA was greater than 50 would fall to the back of the line. Is that what you implied? And the other question is, are you asking for letters of support as part of the application? It wasn't clear in the RFA. Hello?
Dr. Pham? If you'd hold on just one moment, please.
Ms. Colin, if your line is on mute, please unmute.
Not on mute.
And it appears that the line of Ms. Colin has temporarily dropped once again. Please stay on the line while we attempt to make another connection.
I'm so sorry for the technical difficulties. We are very grateful for your patience. Thank you.
Excuse me, the line of Ms. Cohen has been returned to the conference.
We apologize. We're really not trying to run away. Stephen, I believe
should I repeat the questions?
Yes, please.
Okay. The first question was, you had mentioned earlier about the PSAs in excess of perhaps 50%, that they would be prioritized to the end of the list. Is that what you implied? And the other question is, there is no place in the application, it appears, for letters of support being requested, and was that your intent? Or would you like some letters of support sent in with the application, and how would that be accomplished?
So on your first question, Stephen, the FTC DOJ guidelines apply only to organizations formed after March 20th, 2010. I'm not sure what your situation is, but organizations that were established before then do not have to worry about these boundaries. In answer to your second question, we are not explicitly prioritizing letters of support other than from the applicant's other purchasers with regard to their other outcomes-based contracts. But you decide what's best to put into the application. We've tried to give you parameters for the things that we're going to be looking at in terms of selection criteria.
And so that would be consistent and perhaps with attachments?
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you. Our next question, please, Sean.
And your next question comes from the line of Jay Johnson from the Wenatchee Valley Medical Center. Your line is now open.
Yeah, thank you. Could you maybe just give a high-level view, sort of a summary of the financial incentives, comparing historic low-cost areas with the goals of the trend line and so on and so forth? Could you just kind of walk everyone through that? Because I read it a few times, and I wasn't exactly clear on where you were going with that.
Are you talking about whether or not an ACO is offered a two-year extension?
No, I'm just talking about succeeding in the program.
Yeah. Okay. Well, as we've discussed earlier in the call, the base year costs are established based on the actual costs of the aligned beneficiaries. So that has no regional distortions in it. It's the data are what they are. Where the issue you're raising comes into play is when we trend that forward from the baseline to an expenditure target. And as we indicated on the call, we'll be using a national cohort who has similar characteristics as far as alignability in the base period. Some observers have noted that using that national rate of growth provides a built-in benefit for areas that are low cost today. This is a feature that was in the proposed rule for the shared savings program to just use the dollar increase in the national growth rate. We propose to use a blend, 50% of the dollar increase in the national rate of growth and 50% of the percentage increase. We feel this will mitigate some of those effects. We actually have noticed, though, that we're still testing whether, in fact, the variations from area to area and, in fact, the variations from where we're likely to get ACOs are as great as some have speculated. But the short answer to your question is some observers have noted that low-cost areas might be somewhat advantaged in the formula and higher-cost areas disadvantaged. We're still running data to see the degree whether that's a meaningful difference.
Well, but are you working against the trend then?
Correct. So your base is the actual expenditures that your aligned beneficiaries had in the prior 3 years trended to the current period, and what your expenditure target, the target you'll be trying to beat, will be based on a, as I said, a 50-50 hybrid of the national rate of growth for the coming year. So.
And the absolute dollar equivalent.
Yeah, so 50% of it will be the percentage increase in the national rate of growth, 50% will be the dollar increase in the average national rate of growth.
So you have no advantage if you've been in a historic low-cost area, or no disadvantage if you've been in, say, Dade County?
I would say some observers have noted that you would have some advantage for historically being in a low-cost area because the rate of growth is not from a low-cost area, it's from the national average.
Well, if I could have a second question, on page 8, it talks about minimum average annual savings amounts no greater than 5% with in ACOs and states with the lowest Medicare expenditure levels.
Yeah, so that...
Is that backwards or am I backwards?
No, that's correct English. It is a lot of double negatives, and we can explain. We can walk through that for you. So that is a somewhat different issue. That is not to do with trending your baseline to your benchmark, but rather asking the question, at the end of year two, have you performed sufficiently well that we feel comfortable shifting you to population-based payments? And to make that assessment, we just want to take the average of your savings performance in years one and two. And what that paragraph is saying is that if you are in the lowest cost state, then that minimum average of your 2 years performance will be 5%. And if you are in the highest cost state, that minimum average performance will be 1%. And it will vary continuously in between depending on the historical expenditure levels in your state. We have done analyses on these minimums, and based on our projections of the likely performance of ACOs in different types of geographic regions, we believe that this is an equitable approach to allow everyone roughly equal opportunity to get to population-based payments.
So if you're in a low-cost area, then the bar is 5%, and if you're in a high-cost area, it's 1%?
That's correct. However, if you're in a low-cost area, you're starting ahead of the game already because we are using a national reference population, not a regional reference population.
Yeah, but the gentleman said earlier it was a trend. You win
That's
by
right.
beating the trend.
That's so right. The low-cost areas also happen to be the low-trend areas, typically.
Okay.
Thank
you. The way I would summarize this is that observers have noted that the shared savings program formula, which applies a strict absolute dollar increase, greatly advantages providers in low-cost areas. And what I would say is that the Pioneer model somewhat less so, but still advantages providers in low-cost areas.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Our next question, please, Sean.
Your next question comes from the line of Tammy Workman from the Ohio State University Medical Center. Your line is now open.
Hello, this is Chris Ellison representing the Ohio State University Medical Center. We had... two questions. First, in terms of determination of expenditures for the beneficiaries in our base year, are direct medical education and indirect medical education expenses determined and added into that, or are they excluded?
We will include all Part A and B expenditures, so IME will be included, but not DME.
Yeah, it's not that they're A and B. All claims-based expenses.
Sorry, all claims.
Parts A and B.
And the second question is a follow-up, I think, to one of the other questions, was are we permitted the flexibility to construct our own payment structure?
You are certainly encouraged to do that and to submit them as suggestions. However, I want to emphasize that ultimately, for the Pioneer Participation Agreements, we'll be offering a menu, if you will, but a limited menu, because we want to emphasize that we want to hear from applicants what alternative arrangements should look like, but we do need to distill them and synthesize them down to a manageable one or two with variations within each, because at the end of the day, the Innovation Center has to produce an evaluation for Congress and for the administration, and that requires having enough consistency across participants that we can actually draw firm conclusions.
Yes, we understand that. And just a follow-up, in to pioneer ACO, would advanced payment model be something that you might consider?
I would strongly encourage you to fully leverage the opportunity to submit suggestions on comprehensive suggestions on alternative payment arrangements. And the more concrete and specific you are, particularly if you provide justifications, the better opportunities we have to be responsive to them.
Thank you.
Thank you. Our next question, please.
Yes, ma'am. Once again, just a friendly reminder that in order to ask a question or make a comment, please press star then the number one on your telephone keypad. Your next question comes from the line of Deborah Baverman from American Universal. Your line is now open.
Yes, we actually have two questions related to provider participation. What is the methodology anticipated for terminating a provider with or without cause? And then also related to that, how would we limit providers from participating in more than one ACO? The primary care physician.
So can I just ask for clarification? When you said terminate provider, did you mean individual providers or did you mean an entire ACO?
Individual providers who are not performing to the quality standards.
And you are asking what the conditions are for the ACO to be allowed to do that or for CMS too?
For the ACO.
I think that is within the ACO's governing purview to make those decisions, and that is not a level of micromanagement that CMS would get involved in.
Terrific. We appreciate that.
That whether or not to continue affiliation with an individual provider is really up to the ACO's governing body and not for CMS to lay guidelines for, with the exception of program integrity guidelines, right, so that we will be monitoring providers and organizations just as Medicare normally does for any breaches of laws or regulations. And so those are the only conditions under which we would intervene in those affiliations. Otherwise, it's really up to the ACO. The other question...
I would add two things to my answer. One is, since each provider was used as for the alignment and the establishment of the baseline and the expenditure target, you can terminate from the ACO during the year, but those beneficiaries will stay and those expenses will stay in the calculation for that year. They could be updated in a subsequent year. And also, we would be interested in whether when you terminate a particular provider, whether that has any effect on the minimum number of aligned beneficiaries that you're required to maintain.
Right. And I just wanted to clarify also that while applicants will be submitting complete lists of NPIs and TINs for their affiliated providers and member organizations, we would ask Pioneer ACOs to resubmit updated lists of those identifiers at the beginning of each year in order to conduct alignment. Your other question was regarding exclusive affiliation with an ACO and how would we enforce it. Because we have the NPIs, we would be able to flag a provider once that provider has been affiliated, linked with a specific ACO, and that provider will then essentially, we will have an alert for if that NPI shows up on another ACO's list of affiliations.
And then would CMS notify the ACO in that instance? Because we have providers who are unfortunately being courted by multiple ACOs, and one ACO may not know that the provider had signed up with another.
We will bear that news, and then we will remove ourselves from the conversation. Yeah.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you. Sean, our next question, please.
Yes, ma'am. Your next question comes from the line of Jack Summers from Community Care. Your line is now open.
I have two questions. The first one, we appreciate the flexibility on the payment methodology, and you've said that you want ideas from the plans and from participants. The first question is, can we do that prior to year three? Is the flexibility time-wise as well as methodology? And the second question is around the 15,000 beneficiary limit. Is that set in stone?
Regarding your first question, Yes, I should clarify. The alternative payment arrangement suggestions that applicants submit can address the entire length of the Pioneer model. So not just in year three. It can include different parameters for years one through five.
So if we want global cap out of the gate, we can ask for that.
You are welcome to ask for that. Regarding your second question, the 15,000 beneficiary threshold is rather firm, except for rural ACOs. We're not going to quibble with 14,975. However, we did pick that threshold for a reason, and that's because we made an assessment about the level of financial risk that we were exposing providers to. And beyond, at 15,000, roughly 15,000 beneficiaries, the risk pool becomes such that estimates of risk are actually much more stable.
Thank you very much. We appreciate it.
Hey, Sean, our next question, please.
Your next question comes from the line of Jennifer Jackman from Monarch Healthcare. Your line is now open.
Thank you. I just wanted to follow up on the clarification that was given to the other woman about primary care providers and if they switch or are courted by other ACOs. I understand if you terminate a provider, the member stay aligned with you for the purposes of calculation of expenditures, but if a primary care provider actually switches to another ACO, what happens to their aligned beneficiaries?
They stay with you.
For the whole period or just until
for that performance year?
For that performance year. Thank you.
Now, our next question, please.
Again, star one to ask a question or make a comment. Your next question comes from the line of Marnie Bussell from Iowa Medicaid. Your line is now open.
Yes, thank you. My question is, from CMS's perspective, do you see a conflict to attribute a Medicare member to both a Pioneer ACO organization and, say, a Medicare medical home or health home program?
I'll just reiterate that what we encourage providers to participate in multiple seamless care coordination models. What we cannot do is to pay out shared savings more than once for a specific beneficiary. So we will be reconciling beneficiary alignment lists on our end across programs that have a shared savings component.
So I'm not familiar with all of the dual projects that Medicare is participating from the health home perspective, but do you consider those shared savings if they are, say, care coordination payments?
The care coordination payments themselves do not constitute shared savings. If they are netted out of shared savings at the end, then there are shared savings at the end. My understanding is that some of the health home pilots have a shared savings component and some of them don't.
Thank you very much.
Sean, our next question, please.
Your next question comes from the line of Keith Pleasy from Brown and Tolan Physicians. Your line is now open.
Thank you. My additional question is, would you consider population-based reimbursement equivalent to an outcomes-based contract? Does population-based reimbursement fulfill the request for applications focus on the ACO having multiple payer contracts, the majority of revenues being outcomes-based?
It could contribute to that 50% criterion if it's accompanied by substantial quality and patient experience incentives or standards.
Okay, thank you.
Sean, our next question, please.
Again, star one to ask a question or make a comment. Your next question comes from the line of David Durbin from SOSAM Healthcare. Your line is now open.
Thank you. Could you repeat the 800 number and the call number for those who may want to listen to this a second time?
Sure. It's 1-800-642-1687, and the passcode is 70961. 1792, and that'll be available at about 5:30 Eastern Standard Time, or Eastern Daylight Time, sorry.
Thank you very much.
Excuse me, Ms. Sibuhar, pardon the interruption, the passcode is actually 7096-1782.
Sorry about that.
That's quite all right. Your next question comes from the line of Dr. Gary Wehner from Chicago Health Systems. Your line is now open.
Hi, thank you. Under question 13, the second bullet, there's a request for documents or agreements relating to the ability of the ACO participants to compete with the ACO. It goes on to describe some other information that's needed, which seems to run contrary to the exclusivity notion of PCPs in ACO. I was wondering if you can comment on that.
I'm not sure I understand the question.
The bullet says document. They're requesting documents or agreements relating to the ability of the ACO participants to compete with the ACO. That is because the ACO participant is not exclusive to the ACO, either individually or through other ACOs or entities. And again, I'm not understanding it well, but it seems like it runs contrary to the notion of a PCP being assigned to a single ACO.
I believe that you're referring to text speaking about specialist members of the ACO. And specialists are not required to be exclusively affiliated with one ACO.
Okay, but that's not what the question asks in the application.
I think that if you start from the top of the FTCDOJ section of the application, it's, for example, when it comes to calculating market shares at the zip code level, that they are very much focused on specialty services.
So that second bullet is in reference to specialists then?
That is my understanding.
Okay, thank you.
Sean, our next question, please.
Your next question. Question comes from a participant whose information is not yet transcribed. Please state your name and organization. Your line is now open.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead, please.
Yes, this is Dr. Saraya from Florida Medical Clinic. Sorry that the information didn't come through. The question is, when CMS decides to give the population-based payments to the physician in year three and onwards, is it inclusive, is it for primary care physician and the specialist both, and how will that information be determined?
The population-based payments will be made to the ACO, not to individual providers. The individual providers that are members of the ACO would receive 50% of their fee-for-service reimbursements, and it would be up to the ACO to determine how to allocate the remainder that would be in the population-based payments. So it is not by provider. It is for patients at the level of the ACO.
So it is the, to clarify, the population-based payment will be in the form of a lump sum payment for all primary care, specialty, and Part A, et cetera, all combined. Is that correct?
It would be for all services for that particular population, yes. Paid as a per beneficiary per month amount.
Correct. Okay, I understand now. Okay.
Thank you, Dr. Sura. Our next question, please.
Again, star one to ask a question or make a comment. Your next question comes from the line of Jay Johnson from the Wenatchee Valley Medical Center. Your line is now open.
On page 20, item number C, governance structure, talks about the composition of the governing body is reflective of member groups of providers and suppliers that form the ACO, include meaningful representation from consumer advocates and patients. Most professional services groups are governed by state law in regard to who can be on the board, and that covers most group practices, I think, you know, particularly in Washington State, but that seems to go contrary to many state laws. Could you comment?
Sure. So I believe that section of the RFA, if you look not at the application but in the RFA where we talk about governance structure requirements, We state that there is an exception for extenuating circumstances such as legal restrictions on the composition of the governing body. We just ask that you fully document that for us.
Okay,
but I want to emphasize that all things considered, we will highly prioritize organizations that are committed to involving patients and consumers in their governance.
Well, but again, you're dealing with state legislatures on that, but I understand your point.
Thank you for your comments, Mr. Johnson. Our next question, please.
Again, star one to ask a question or make a comment. And there are no further questions in the queue at this time. We'll turn the call back. Oh, excuse me, just as I said that, a question came in from the line of Carmela Dunford from North Shore Law. Your line is now open.
Hello, I'm calling from North Shore Long Island Jewish Health System. And our question is, in counting eligible patients in our primary care physician's practices, can we count patients who are long-term residents in a skilled nursing facility?
If they have eligible evaluation and management services, then yes.
Okay.
John, do we have any
Thank
more
you.
Questions?
The next question in the queue comes from the line of Elizabeth Flashner. Please state your organization. Your line is now open.
Center for Health Policy Research and Ethics, George Mason University. I'm just wondering, can a primary care physician serve and part of an ACO and then see patients who are not part of the ACO, like that aren't on Medicare at all?
Absolutely. Yes, absolutely. We should emphasize that the Medicare ACO models on offer do not involve beneficiary enrollment or lock-in. They do not involve gatekeeping or pre-authorization. It is traditional Medicare, and we fully expect that ACOs will see some patients that are not aligned with them. We also expect that some aligned patients, some patients who have been aligned with an ACO will also see other providers at times.
Thank you.
Our next question, if we have one.
There are no further questions in the queue at this time.
Barb, I just wanted to repeat for everyone on the line that if you think of additional questions, if you need follow-up on specific issues, to please send them to us, the Pioneer question inbox, which is pioneeraco@cms.hhs.gov. And we have a pretty good track record of rapid turnaround. The Innovation Center website has many of the documents that have been referenced today, and that address is www.innovations.cms.gov.
I want to thank everybody for joining today's call. I also want to make sure that folks know the 800 number for the Encore call in case there was somebody that needs to listen to it. It'll be available by 5:30 Eastern Time, and you can dial 1-800-642-1687 and ask for call number 7096-1782. That's 7096-1782. I don't hear any other questions yet, Sean. I think that we can probably go ahead and disconnect, encourage folks to disconnect.
This concludes today's conference call. You may now disconnect.